This is 1A. I'm Jen White. The war in Ukraine has touched every part of our life, from where we get our gas to how we fix our cars to who becomes a parent. By some estimates, Ukraine is one of the largest surrogacy hubs in the world. It's one of only a few countries that allows foreign surrogacy arrangements, and the cost of using a surrogate there is much lower than it is in the U.S. The ongoing war in Ukraine is one of several reasons why the U.S. is facing a major shortage of surrogates. According to the New York Times, the number of potential surrogates is down 60%. Today, we'll zoom in on paid surrogacy here in the U.S. and talk about what's behind the shortage and why surrogacy is so expensive in the first place. Joining us now from Greenwich, Connecticut is Dr. Deepika Garg. She's an OBGYN and a professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences at Yale University School of Medicine. Dr. Garg, welcome to 1A.
Thank you. I appreciate having, and I'm very excited to be present here and answer any questions people might have.
Also with us, surrogate Ashley Marico in Las Vegas. She's the surrogate program director at Surrogate First. That's a national agency based in Los Angeles. Ashley, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for allowing me to be here.
And Melissa Brisman joins us now from Montvale, New Jersey. She's a reproductive lawyer and the founder of Reproductive Possibilities. That's the national surrogacy agency based in New Jersey. Melissa, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Dr. Garg, let's start with some basics. What are the different types of surrogacies?
Sure. So, gestational surrogacy is more traditional that people use. So, in gestational surrogacy, a woman carries pregnancy and not biologically related with the kid. So, basically, the gametes come from the genetic parents and the person carries the pregnancy. And there is a direct surrogate that used to be having the biological relationship with the pregnancy they used to carry, but they are not basically used anymore in our country.
So that type of surrogacy, commonly called traditional surrogacy, that's where the surrogate's egg would be used. But today we're focusing on gestational surrogacy, where the embryo is from the intended parents and implanted in a surrogate. Can you walk us through the medical process for gestational surrogacy?
Sure. So for gestational surrogacy, the embryo is transferred in the uterus of gestational surrogate. So genetic parents, they have to basically create the embryo. They have to undergo IVF process where we take out the eggs from the mother and the sperm from the father and fertilize them in our IVF laboratory outside and then grow these embryos. And there is like FDA guidelines. We have to test these genetic parents do thorough evaluation in terms of detailed history, physical examination, and do some testing to make sure that they don't have any communicable disease. And then once these embryos are created, then these are transferred to gestational surrogate. And surrogate also has to be fit to carry a pregnancy. There is an extensive evaluation in terms of psychological evaluation, history, and physical examination and some testing, which is based on ASRM practice guidelines. ASRM is American Society of Reproductive Medicine, which oversee all the third-party reproduction and ART, artificial reproductive technique in our country.
Melissa, you used a surrogate for all three of your children. Why did you decide to go that route?
Well, I was born with a medical problem where my uterus couldn't hold a baby. And so I knew this when I got married. I got married fairly young. I was 23 years old. And I was the first person at the hospital at Boston IVF to use a gestational carrier. So my physician told me to get started on looking for someone when I first got married and that they would try and help me. And I actually just got lucky in that the procedure worked within a few months of me getting married, and I had, you know, twins about a year after I got married.
Dr. Garg, what are some of the other common reasons people decide to use a surrogate?
Sure. So sort of gestational carriers, they mainly be used when there is a true medical condition that prevents biologic parents to carry a pregnancy. So, for example, as Melissa said, she had a condition where she cannot carry a pregnancy. Some of the examples are if someone doesn't have uterus or they have like significant uterine anomaly, they cannot carry a pregnancy, or there is a medical condition which is a contraindication for pregnancy, for example, pulmonary hypertension, or there are some other medical conditions which causes a severe risk to either mother or the baby when they are pregnant. So these are some of the conditions. And these days, if there is a biological inability to conceive for like single male or homosex male couples, then, you know, these are some of the examples when people can use surrogates.
Ashley, you've been a surrogate 3 times. You're embarking on your fourth pregnancy now. Can you give us an overview of the process from start to finish from your side of things?
Sure. Yeah. The first one is to research. So I probably researched for about a year, the medications, the process, what that looked like. Once I signed up, it was a pretty extensive application. I want to say it was something like almost a dozen pages of information. At that point, the agency will interview a few times and start to gather all medical records that are available. I had to go through a psychological screening, background checks, drug panels, and then some more meetings with the agency. And just to more educate, to let me know, you know, how long it was going to take and what to expect. And the process was pretty long. I remember it taking, and even to this day, it still takes about 6 to 8 weeks to go through screening. And then to match with my family, that took probably another month or so. For me, it was a lot longer because I was a little bit of I hadn't had a child for quite some time. And so then I think it was like 7 years that I hadn't had a child. But most times it's a pretty quick matching process, and then about 3 to 6 months till pregnancy. So it's pretty long.
We're talking to surrogate Ashley Marico, Melissa Brisman, a reproductive lawyer, and Dr. Deepika Garg, an OBGYN. Melissa, give us a sense of the patchwork of surrogacy laws in the U.S.
Well, the United States, unfortunately, doesn't have uniform laws for a lot of things. It leaves the laws up to the state government bodies. So the same is with adoption. So, for instance, you could get a gestational surrogate in California. You could use the egg and sperm of anybody but the carrier, compensate her, get the parent on the birth certificate, be able to request terminations, all sorts of things. Then you can look at Michigan, and where it is a felony to pay a carrier, and that all agreements with carriers, whether they are paid or unpaid, are unenforceable. Then you can look at Louisiana, where they consider an embryo a human being, and you cannot even destroy an embryo, never mind do a surrogacy there. So it's all over the gamut, and you really need to have a lawyer look at your process before you undergo it. Part of the issue also is that you have a lot of intersecting laws, right? So let's say Ashley is your surrogate and she lives in California, and her agency is in Nevada, and the doctor is in New Jersey, and the parents live in China. What law is going to apply, right? You need a lawyer to say, obviously, we're not going to use Chinese law because it's illegal there and the parents live there. Is Nevada better because that's where the agency is? Is California better because that's where the surrogate is? Is New Jersey better because that's where the clinic is? So you need to have your choice of law provisions examined very carefully.
And we should mention that surrogacy in the U.S. is prohibitively expensive for a lot of intended parents. Many agencies report surrogacy costs ranging from between $90,000 and $200,000. Melissa, how does that compare to the cost of surrogacy abroad in, say, Ukraine?
So the surrogacy process in the Ukraine is going to be significantly cheaper because everything is cheaper in the Ukraine. However, there are significant risks, and it doesn't always come out to be beneficial to go abroad. In the United States, you can do surrogacy on a budget. You just have to do your research. You may have to find your own carrier, which can be done with the right guide. What scares me about going abroad is that I have been doing this since 1998, and I have been an attorney through the earthquake in Nepal, through the crisis in Ukraine now, and the crisis that there was a couple of years ago when India shut its doors to surrogacy mid-pregnancy. There are significant risks if there's a pandemic, getting back into the country, getting citizenship. There is no FDA. Here, the FDA inspects, examines, and regulates the transport and transfer of human tissue, meaning eggs and sperm or human tissue, and does everything they can to make sure that the baby or fetus that is growing in the womb of the gestational carrier is actually from the embryo that it was supposed to be. There have been significant mix-ups in the Ukraine where the baby that came out is not biologically the baby that was supposed to be put in. I have had clients who have been stuck in places like the Ukraine or Nepal for 3 or 4 months, meaning that they're losing wages, they're maybe lose their job. So the $30,000 that they were saving just got lost, not to mention the medical care if the baby is born early. So in one of my cases in India, baby was born 8 weeks early. The baby has severe mental incapacities as a result of the care that was received in India, where...
Melissa, let's pause here for a moment. We're talking with Melissa Brisman, a reproductive lawyer, Dr. Deepika Garg, an OBGYN, and surrogate Ashley Marico. Coming up, is the COVID-19 vaccine required for surrogates, and what's at stake if it isn't? I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're talking about surrogacy with Dr. Deepika Garg. She's an OBGYN and a professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences at Yale University School of Medicine. Also with us, surrogate Ashley Marico. She's the surrogate program director at the agency Surrogate First. And Melissa Brisman. She's a reproductive lawyer and the founder of the surrogacy agency Reproductive Possibilities. We also want to hear from you if you're a surrogate or you've worked with one in your family. Zach emailed, "My wife gave birth to a beautiful baby girl for a same-sex couple a couple of months ago. We were all in contact with each other constantly throughout the process, and even though they live 6 states away, they have become family to us. They took several trips here to see us, and we're looking forward to visiting them next month. We love them and are so happy to have grown our family while growing theirs." You can share your story, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. Melissa, you were sharing the story of one of your clients who engaged in surrogacy overseas and some of the complications they ran into. The child was born with some health challenges. Could you briefly explain what happened from there?
Yes. The child was born 8 weeks early, and because they were in India without the knowledge of what hospital would be best to care for the baby received care, but it was not as robust as it would be in the United States. And so the baby has some learning deficiencies and challenges that most of the pediatricians that the baby has seen in the United States feel would have been avoided, and that the baby would have thrived if it was born in the United States. So if you have no other choice, you just cannot do surrogacy in the United States because it is not affordable to you, then of course, an option is to go abroad. But as you can see with the pandemic and other situations that have arisen, the reason why it is much cheaper in places like Ukraine is because you are not getting as robust services and you could be risking the health of your baby. And if you can afford it, in my opinion, it is not an area in which you want to save money by going abroad. There are significant ways to save money in the United States. There are jobs that offer employee benefits and amounts paid towards surrogacy. For instance, Starbucks, I think, recently announced they give a significant amount of money towards surrogacy. Google, LinkedIn, Facebook, a lot of companies are starting to pay towards it. Health insurance companies may pay for your retrieval. You may also apply for scholarships. A website called Fertility IQ lists a lot of those scholarships that are available. there are lots of ways to find a carrier on your own. It is much more difficult. Obviously, clients that come to the agency that I work at and the agency that Ashley works at prefer to have the handholding and the guidance. But if you do your research and you do the screening correctly, you could find somebody on your own, and that could significantly decrease your cost. So I would encourage people to do their homework about trying to do it in the United States.
Ashley, as we said, you're embarking on your fourth surrogacy. What drew you to this type of work?
So I actually dealt with secondary infertility male factor. We had had our two children and everything was great, but we were young, not financially in a good place. And so we decided we were going to wait a couple years and get ourselves together and buy a house. And then we got to that place, and due to some health issues and medications my husband was on, we could no longer have children. So I spent 2 years being pretty bitter until I kind of got kicked in the gut with the realization that I had two children at home, and there were people that were struggling to not have any children. And that's kind of when I embarked on this journey to become a surrogate. I had someone in my small Bible study group that was pregnant, and I congratulated her, and she said, "Oh no, I'm a surrogate." And I thought, what in the world is this? I came from an island in Hawaii. I've never heard of surrogacy. And I thought, this is it. This is my calling. I'm going to carry a baby for someone. And so I did. I went through all of the programs. Unfortunately, my first two attempts were more so learning. I was with an agency that, you know, that maybe that they had not disclosed or properly matched me and my intended parents. We got to legal, and an amazing attorney that I was with said, "Hey, I don't think you guys are lining up on these items." And so we decided to part ways, and I went with another agency where I met my first intended parents. We went through the process. However, after 5 years of failed IVF, I got pregnant, and my intended mom with her failed IVF ended up getting pregnant too. So we were 3 weeks apart. And that's kind of adventure when your parent is an international. So we went on that journey. I gave birth, and just getting to see the intended parents' faces and that love and excitement and all the pain and suffering they went through, definitely got me hooked. And so I thought, I'm only going to do one. And, you know, now I'm three down and I'm going, okay, this is my last one. I was retired. However, my intended parents had asked me for my first two journeys if I would carry their last, you know, baby. And I couldn't picture anyone else doing it. They're part of my family. And so I thought, okay, I will get working out and lose that extra weight and be prepared for a healthy pregnancy.
Dr. Garg, what are the health and lifestyle requirements for becoming a surrogate?
Well, there are some specific recommendations based on ASRM to becoming surrogate. So there's like a specific age range. They have to be between 21 and 45 years of age. BMI cutoff, as Ashley said. And so they have to be in good shape, and they should not have any medical condition that makes them like when they are pregnant, they should not have like a high-risk pregnancy, and they should have at least one full-term pregnancy before they become surrogate. And for normal deliveries, they can have maximum of 5 uncomplicated normal deliveries or maximum 3 cesarean deliveries before, not more than these if they want to carry a baby. And they should be psychologically screened. They should be able to carry baby for someone else. And so these are some basic requirements that was posted by ASRM for surrogacy.
And ASRM is the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. Melissa, according to the CDC, over 18,000 infants were born via gestational surrogacy between 1999 and 2013. What do we know about the rates of surrogacy now?
I think that surrogacy is grossly underreported by the CDC, because when you're an infertility patient, you stay under the care of your infertility doctor for a little bit longer. And because usually you're local to your clinic, you report your birth, whereas most gestational carriers do not. So I actually think that it's quite a bit higher because people aren't reporting to the CDC. I do think that the reason why there is a shortage of surrogates is because the number of people seeking surrogates has gone up significantly each year. It's gone up hundreds and hundreds of percent. The reasons for that are pretty robust. For instance, When I was young, it wasn't as common for same-sex couples to get married, live together, and have children. Now that society is much more accepting of different lifestyles and family arrangements, you see all same-sex males, if they want to have children, they're going to either need to adopt, do a co-parenting arrangement, or a surrogacy. So that has increased. The television and radio shows like this, which give out the knowledge to the general public of what surrogacy is, certainly where Ashley and I live, it's going to be common for people to know about surrogacy. However, if you live in a small town in Oklahoma or, you know, Minnesota, you may not have access except for the radio and TV. So that has increased. The success of IVF has gone up from when I had my kids to about 40 to 50% per cycle to in some cases as high as 85%. So the success increasing makes people more willing to spend and do it. And also you have people having children older, meaning that a lot of times people now may need a carrier to have a child. So the demand has increased greatly.
Dr. Garg, I know we have to let you go soon to see patients, but I wanted to make sure to mention that COVID-19 vaccination has become a major sticking point in the surrogacy industry. Agencies around the country have reported that many potential surrogates don't want to get vaccinated. So first off, what does the data tell us about the impact of COVID-19 on pregnant patients?
Sure. I'm glad you brought this topic here because, you know, COVID vaccine, it's, I would say, since the demand, as Melissa was saying, the demand of surrogacy has been increased and there is shortage of GCs. I mean, it's hard, and since COVID hit in 2020, we have been seeing that it used to take match families with GCs like 3 to 6 months. It's taking somewhere 6 to 12 months or over a year now. And COVID vaccine is one of the reasons because, you know, some of the intended parents, they want their GC to be vaccinated, but if the person is not vaccinated or the other way, some intended parents, they don't want their GC to be vaccinated. So it's hard to match with, you know, same person. And for example, I had a patient who had, who came to us for sibling journey, as Ashley said, that she's carrying a third child for the same intended parent. And they wanted to have this GC to use for their second kid, but this GC was not vaccinated and they wanted her to be vaccinated. And it's hard to convince people. And even the lot of data about like adverse pregnancy outcomes when you develop COVID, when you are pregnant, or you can even miscarry. Some people, they don't want to get vaccinated. So we had to create an exception to use that GC who was not COVID vaccinated. And these intended parents, they agreed to use the same GC because they wanted to have same GC for their second child.
And by GC, you mean gestational carrier. Melissa, what does your agency require around vaccination?
We leave it up to the doctor, but I could say tell you that 95% of the facilities require the carrier to be vaccinated. And we don't want to give medical advice. However, we do tell all of our clients that almost every medical facility is going to require it and that the medical facilities are telling us that it's in your best interest to have your carrier be vaccinated. So as a result, almost all our clients are requiring their carriers to be vaccinated. However, a very large percentage of the carriers come from more rural areas of the country where there is vaccination fear and misinformation. And so you are seeing a decreased pool of available carriers because of the requirement to get vaccinated.
Dr. Garg, before we let you go, you wanted to jump back in?
Well, I can stay a little longer. I have moved my patient for later in the afternoon. And I would like to testify, as Melissa said. So at our place, we require our carriers to be vaccinated. And that's why this patient needed an exception. We have to basically let this carrier carry the pregnancy for intended parents. In that case, even intended parents want her to be vaccinated, but she totally refused.
We're talking to Dr. Deepika Garg. She's an OBGYN and a professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences at Yale University School of Medicine. Also with us, surrogate Ashley Marico and Melissa Brisman, a reproductive lawyer. We're also hearing from you. Libby emailed, I just gave birth to my niece's baby 5 weeks ago. It wouldn't have been possible for them if it weren't for me offering to do it altruistically. I live in Virginia, which is not a surrogacy-friendly state. We still had a contract and everything was officially done, but due to laws in this state, technically the baby was mine and my husband's for 72 hours after birth before we could sign her over. Melissa, I want to dig a little bit more into the laws and ethics around surrogacy, starting with the Baby M case. This is a 1985 case and was the first time a court considered surrogacy. Give us a brief synopsis of the case and how the court ruled.
Sure. So the Baby M case is a very old case from the 80s, and it is not really relevant to what we're speaking about, because in Baby M, the woman who carried the baby was also the biological man. That is today what we refer to as genetic surrogacy. So the birth person is also the genetic mom using her own egg. In exchange for a fee of $10,000, Mary Beth Whitehead was asked to carry and surrender a baby to the Stearns, using, you know, it was an artificial insemination using the intended father's sperm and Mary Beth Whitehead's egg. The case went to the New Jersey Supreme Court. The New Jersey Supreme Court ruled that the contract was unenforceable, and the payment of the money was potentially criminal. Not that genetic surrogacy would be illegal in any state. You could do it. However, you have two issues. One, the woman giving birth cannot surrender her own biological child, meaning place it for adoption with the intended father and the intended mother until after birth. And two, there can be no monetary compensation in exchange for carrying that baby. Actually, New Jersey now has a statute regulating gestational, not genetic surrogacy, making it legal and enforceable. I actually helped draft that legislation, and it was enacted in 2018. It's called the Gestational Carrier Act. So those two types of surrogacy are different.
We got this tweet from Christine, who says the application process can break down even if the psychological interviews come back fine. As the potential parents, we are out thousands and there are no repercussions for the potential surrogate. We have an embryo that needs a home. We're still grieving after 2 years. Ashley, you and the intended parent or parents enter into an agreement when you embark on a pregnancy. What kinds of considerations go into that agreement, into that contract?
Yeah, definitely. And I'm sure that Melissa can explain this too at better legalese terms, but I always try to explain it as it is my responsibility, the intended parents' responsibilities, the state statutes, and our compensation agreement. So things in there would be, you know, avoiding skydiving or horseback riding, whatever was requests that are normally OBGYN requests from, you know, that are recommended. I'd also would say things like I'm not allowed to leave my state after 26 weeks or 30 weeks. Reason for that would be that my insurance is based out of my state. The legal laws that we're under are under my state. And if I was to go out of state, it could affect their parentage or it could affect the cost of health insurance if there was an emergency. So just keeping in mind just those common things, not being around large crowds, you know, with COVID. I'm making sure to properly follow, you know, masking and hand washing to protect myself that way. Definitely not leaving the country, but items like that. And then comes in the compensation where it would break down into, you know, a surrogate's base compensation, which is the compensation they receive for the pain and suffering of the pregnancy, reimbursements, you know, if there was lost wages, childcare, things that would the cost of a pregnancy that would come out of my pocket for doing this pregnancy, they reimburse those kind of items. And so all of that's in there along with the state statutes. And then we will do another contract. I'm in a pre-birth state, which is a state where the parents, we will sign a contract. It'll get filed with the courts that recognizes them as the parents to go directly onto the birth certificate.
We're talking about surrogacy with surrogate Ashley Marico. Melissa Brisman is also with us. She's a reproductive lawyer, and Dr. Deepika Garg, an OBGYN at Yale University School of Medicine. I'm Jen White, back with more in just a moment. This is 1A. Now let's get back to our conversation about surrogacy with Ashley Marico. She's a surrogate and the surrogate program director at the agency Surrogate First. Also with us, Melissa Brisman. She's a reproductive lawyer and the founder of the surrogacy agency Reproductive Possibilities. And Dr. Deepika Garg, an OBGYN and professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences at Yale University School of Medicine. We're also hearing from you. Carrie emailed, "I was a surrogate twice. It was something I've wanted to do my whole life. I knew the moment my first surrogate baby was born, I wanted to do it again. It was one of the most profound moments of my life. I will never, ever forget that feeling. My second one, I did end up with complications in delivery and hemorrhage. I needed 2 transfusions. That definitely ended my surrogacy story. Had that not happened, had I been younger, I would have done it a third time." Melissa, what happens if there are complications for the surrogate during a pregnancy or delivery?
Well, if there are complications during the pregnancy, for instance, if the carrier needs to go on bed rest or she needs extra help, that's usually in the contract that the intended parents will provide her with housekeeping, in-home services that she might need. As far as the medical, if there are medical complications, we make sure that she has insurance so the costs are covered. However, if the complications are so severe that they are affecting her overall health and well-being, unfortunately, she could request a termination. Her life is going to take precedent over the baby's life. After the delivery, if there are complications, the baby would be cared for and hopefully be okay. But just like any other birth, babies can have birth defects that need to be attended to. If there are complications to the person carrying, again, the contract should provide her with some assistance. In addition, we do require, and most agencies will require, a significant amount of life insurance for the benefit of the carrier's family. God forbid if she were to be one of the rare incidences where somebody dies during the pregnancy process. Usually the life insurance will cover any death. So if she's hit by a car, if God forbid, she just passes away for any reason, including as a result of the pregnancy. In some cases, we purchase disability for the insurance for the carrier, depending on her job. She has a high paying job that if she were out, she would need those wages replaced. A lot of times we may look into getting a disability policy as well.
And if there are complications with the fetus during the surrogate's pregnancy, how is that managed? Is that part of the contract between the carrier and the parent?
So the contract will even deal with abortions, terminations, surgery on the fetus. However, so those provisions will never be enforceable specifically in any state. So what does that mean? Let's say the baby has a severe fetal defect incompatible with life. All parties agreed in the contract and before that a termination would take place. The carrier has a change of heart, doesn't want to terminate. Nobody can force her to terminate. In some states, we could withhold her fees. We could sue her for damages. Again, this is very rare, and I have not been involved in any situations where there have been lawsuits regarding this, but there have been. The responsibility for the baby will always be the intended parents under the contract. However, a baby can always be placed for adoption if, one, you don't think you could handle it, or, two, situations change. So, for instance, I have not been a party to this situation, but I do know that of cases in which the parents passed away during the pregnancy. God forbid there was a plane crash, a car accident, and the woman who was carrying the baby, there was a provision in the contract who would then get custody of the baby if the parents, just like if you left your kids at a babysitter and you died, then your will would designate where the baby would go.
Dr. Garg, in conversations with your patients around the surrogacy option, I mean, what are the questions you urge them to ask themselves if they're thinking about embarking on this journey?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. And when they come to me, they basically already prepared to use a carrier because they know they cannot be pregnant for the reasons I mentioned earlier. So basically, this is my first question. Are you really ready? And they also undergo a psychological assessment where they basically weigh and see if they are ready for all this. And of course, it's financially, it's they require to pay, not for surrogate, but like for carrier, but also for the care. And as Melissa just described, in different situation they have to pay if so a carrier is going on bed rest or any medical conditions, so they have to be financially strong, or if it's covered by insurance, or if they work for one of those companies, and then basically they have to be they have to undergo IVF process to create embryos, to transfer that embryo to a carrier. So they have to be ready for that process. And they have to undergo extensive FDA testing, which is required by FDA. It includes detailed history, physical examination, laboratory testing, at least 6 months before they create embryos. So they should be ready for that testing, and which includes like testing for sexually transmitted disease. They should not use any IV drugs, and all those tests and HIV, Hep B, Hep C, like regular testing. So we want to make sure, or like FDA, who regulates this process, wants to make sure they do not transmit any of these infection to the carrier where their embryo is going to grow. So they have to be ready, and they have to be ready for the IVF process where, the female partner has to take multiple fertility injections and then come for multiple visits for ultrasounds and has to undergo egg retrieval under anesthesia, and then male partner gives the sperm, and then we create embryos. And sometimes it takes multiple cycles of IVF to create embryos. And if they want to do genetic testing of these embryos, then they have to be ready for the multiple cycles. And yeah, although the success rates are higher these days, and we have different options and different techniques where we can, do genetic testing on these embryos before we transfer these embryos of an embryo to carrier. So this is like an extensive process. We discuss all this in detail during our consults, and if they choose a carrier, it doesn't mean that once they choose that carrier will be accepted. First of all, the carrier should meet all the prerequisites based by American Society of Reproductive Medicine, and that carrier should be, they come here, and then we do again the thorough medical examination, including history, physical examination, and laboratory testing, and make sure that they are healthy enough to carry a pregnancy. And as Ashley said, they have to go through psychology evaluation and all these things.
It's a very long process. I want to get to this tweet we got from Claire, who says, please bring up the possible impacts that the reversal of Roe v. Wade would have on surrogacy. We know that Alabama's already passed a law codifying fetal personhood. A bill in Louisiana would give full rights to embryos, potentially criminalizing IVF. Melissa, assuming Roe is overturned, how are you anticipating the potential impact on surrogacy and in vitro fertilization across the country?
I think that it will increase the wait time that we have now, which is very long, to get a carrier, because a lot of states will have what we call trigger laws, making abortions extremely, extremely difficult in that state. Once you are in a position that you need to hire somebody else to carry your baby, you are already anxious about the loss of control that you have over the pregnancy, right? So if the pregnancy is within the marriage and one of the people are carrying it, there's a control between the person or the couple that is having the baby. Once you lose direction over what that person is eating, doing, there's a fear of that. Now, if you have them in a state where they would have to travel if a termination was needed, and or there could be legal repercussions of actually having a termination, that's an increased fear that the parents will then have, and they won't want carriers from that state. Already we're seeing a decrease in the number of carriers from the state of Texas, because Texas criminalizes assistance in abortions. And so a lot of clients want to stay away from getting their carriers in Texas.
We're talking with Melissa Brisman, a reproductive lawyer, Dr. Deepika Garg, an OBGYN at Yale University School of Medicine, and surrogate Ashley Marico. We're also hearing from you. Claire tweeted, surrogacy agency director here in Minnesota. Surrogacy laws here are favorable, and it's very well represented in the Twin Cities area. We have four reputable IVF clinics within an hour. Also, we require our carriers to be vaccinated for COVID, and many of our gestational carriers carry for us again. We also got this tweet from one of you who says, someone without a working uterus shouldn't have the right to rent someone else's. This sort of body rental has high potential to exploit women in economically disadvantaged countries. And I'll say, for the sake of this conversation, we're focused on what's happening here in the U.S. But Ashley, I would think that that's something you've heard before. What's your response?
Yeah, that's probably one of the most common things. There's been tons of surveys, and what we found is that most surrogates are middle-class women. We've had teachers, nurses, doctors, lawyers be surrogates.
And that's specifically in the U.S.?
Yes, in the U.S. And there are rules and regulations. The ASRM guidelines state that no one should be on any type of government assistance. And so we look at that. We look at the income. We want to check to make sure that they have, we do a background check and a financial background check. So we're looking to make sure that finances is not the number one priority or the second priority. Yes, it's nice. It's a compensation. It is a mutual benefiting relationship. But if a surrogate is going into this with the whole purpose of an income to pay her rent, we would disqualify. And that's just because we don't want to put anyone in that situation or take advantage of anyone financially.
And Ashley, can you give us a sense of how much you're paid for surrogacy through your agency?
Sure. So I think the average right now is for a first-time surrogate, and this would be anywhere from like $30,000 to $40,000 is a base compensation, and that's that monies that get paid out during the pregnancy. Experienced surrogates normally will make an additional $10,000, and then I've seen, you know, in different states and different agencies where the compensation can be higher, but we stay with the average. We try to stay with the U.S. average.
So the base compensation, but then there's also additional costs for medical care and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So medical care, monthly allowance to cover like your mileage and gas and lost wages. There's maternity leave. If you were to end up on bed rest, you would receive like a bed rest fee if it, you know, doctored ordered to help with like your house and your children, because obviously to be a surrogate, we have to have had a child. So if we go on bed rest, you know, there's that compensation. There's a lot of items to keep us protected. We do get, you know, fees along the way, like milestone fees when we go for transfer or start medications or items like that, that are also, you know, paid out. And so I would say there's probably an additional $5,000 to $15,000 in additional fees, with the lost wages and the maternity leave and things like that.
We got this tweet from another one of you who says, maybe this is a myth, but growing up poor, I always thought surrogacy and adoption were for well-off people who could afford to pay for a baby. Melissa, I mean, what do we know about who actually accesses surrogacy?
So I do think that that is a myth. I think that the desire to have a child is very strong. And when people know that this is their only option, they do a lot of very creative things. They look for scholarships, they do GoFundMes, they look for jobs in which they would pay for it. They make sure they have health insurance that may pay for the retrieval. Also, parents, a lot of time, relatives will chip in and help them pay for this process. Most parents are more than happy to contribute to have a grandchild because it's something that they want. Yes, it is much easier if you are wealthy to do this because that's one aspect you no longer have to think of. But I do think that a lot of middle class clients do access this service. They just have to save for it and be very creative.
Ashley, briefly, what do you wish people understood about what it's like to be a surrogate?
So this may not be the most popular opinion, but I know that a lot of surrogates I speak with is that I don't count as a surrogate being like an angel or, oh my gosh, you know, this is definitely a mutual benefiting relationship. I love watching the parents get excited. I get a lot from being a surrogate. I get to watch them and their excitement and get to see that pain that's healed, you know, through this process and them holding their child. I think there's nothing more pure in a world full of fakeness than to watch someone hold their child for the first time. And I think just that pure, you know, pure experience. I also have been blessed, you know, and I want people to know that I stay in contact with, you know, I've carried for two different families. One family I'm going on my third surrogacy with, and the other family we don't keep in contact, but we build friendships. We build relationships with each other. And definitely the last one would be that we're not in it for the money. If you broke down the base compensation into the hours that we put in and the time it takes with pregnancy and the pain and the suffering and the back pain and the nausea and all the fun stuff, the lumps from the shots, it's not about that for us. That is to compensate us for our time and for us to be fair. But honestly, this experience is more about helping someone else and seeing that joy from them.
Melissa, New York legalized paid gestational surrogacy last year. Very briefly, what are you watching for next on the policy front?
Well, I'm afraid of the Roe versus Wade decision and its impact on IVF and surrogacy. I think that a lot of politicians, I actually helped passed the New York legislation, wrote the New Jersey legislation with a group of other attorneys, actually went to Taiwan in 2010 and helped advise them on their surrogacy statute. So I'm fairly familiar with legislative processes. And I think the biggest thing to take away from that is that politicians are politicians. They know how to pass legislation, but they don't know the subject of the legislation like the advisors, right? They can't, that's not their job. So a big part of the process is educating them. And right now, it's very scary that the politicians are not at all educated when they pass these so-called personhood termination abortions. They have no idea.
We're going to have to leave it there. That's Melissa Brisman in Montvale, New Jersey. She's a reproductive lawyer and founder of Reproductive Possibilities. Also with us, surrogate Ashley Marico and Dr. Deepika Garg. Today's producer was Catherine Fink with help from Mia Estrada. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening. We'll talk more soon. This is 1A.